All right, here we go. All right, so can you start by introducing yourself? Tell me your name, age, nationality, how long you lived in Lewiston when you were there.
My name is Deca Della. I am originally from Somalia, East Africa. I came to Maine in 2005, and I lived in Lewiston at that time. Mm-hmm. And been in Maine since then, but I moved out of Lewiston in 2008. So mm-hmm. I lived in Lewiston for almost 3 years.
Okay. Yeah. And so tell me a little bit about your relationship to being in Lewiston, right? How and why did you come there? Why did you leave?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. That's where I moved from. And in Atlanta, it's a busy, busy town. Mm-hmm. And you will get out of your house 6 o'clock in the morning, try to go to work, and traffic and all of that commotion and busyness of the town and the city, you end up coming home 9, 10 o'clock at night. And I did not like, you know, what I have been doing all of those years, because I'm a person who wanted to have more education for myself, because I'm coming from a background of my father, who was a very well-educated man, and who always tell us to have an education, because that's the only thing that nobody can take away from you. So I always have that at the back of my mind, but then again, see this life living in Atlanta, not allowing me to have more education. Mm-hmm. So my uncle, who lived in Atlanta with us, moved to Maine, in Lewiston, actually. And I always talked to him as a complaining, I cannot go back to school and this and that. He said, you need to come to Maine if you want to do that. I'm like, Maine? Okay. Where? Lewiston. I'm like, okay. I never thought of going to Maine, ever. I didn't even know where Maine was, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I went and visited them in 2004, him and his wife. Mm-hmm. And I was really, really shocked to see the city. It looked like a dead town, mm-hmm. to be honest. Coming from Atlanta, you know, a vibrant, big city, big, yeah. you know, life, the whole 24/7. And coming to Lewiston, which was really dark and not a lot of life going on, if you will. And I was like, what is happening here? Where is everybody? Like, yeah, everybody is in by 7 p.m. Nobody goes out. And like, but I really loved the couple of days that I was there. I met a lot of people who were friends, my friends, who moved from Atlanta at that time, who lived there. And they were like, oh, my God, our life changed. It's really nice. It's no commotion. There is no crimes. There is no traffic. That's one of the bigger things. There's no traffic. So, and a couple of people that I really respected and had a good relationship with, that I know, two nice women, really said, you have to move, especially if you want the kids to go to good schools. And you yourself, you always talk about that you want to go back to school. So do that. So I thought about it. We thought about it, talked to everybody, and we moved in 2005. And it was really, really eye-opening for me. I've seen a lot of community members who can use a lot of support when it comes to, you know, language barriers, mm-hmm. cultural barriers. So I started working for Catholic Charities as an interpreter. Mm-hmm. And then I get a job at the City of Portland. And, you know, the commute was really kind of tough for me because of the mm-hmm. snow, and I was getting used to driving in the snow. Mm-hmm. That was one thing that was like, oh my God, this place is really awesome, but this is no thing. It's just showing up every time. But other than that, it was really nice, good space to live in. You know, a lot of people that I know was in my neighbors and, you know, that community mm-hmm. settings. And also, my kids were really, did not have any Somali American kids mm-hmm. in Atlanta. So they also were in a cultural shock for themselves. My oldest was telling me, where are all the black people? Wow. And I was like, look at them. Somalis everywhere. And he's like, no, I want the, you know, African-American, because those are the people that he get used to
right.
see. So it was kind of cultural education for him as well, that mom and dad and grandma are from Somalia. So you have this culture and that culture. So it was really good decision for me to move in Maine. And it started in Lewiston, where, you know, a lot of people were that I know also were there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I want to ask you two follow-up questions about that. One, your uncle, how long had he been living up here, and why did he come up here, or if you know?
Yeah, I think his wife decided to move there.
Okay.
And he said, okay, let's do it, because they used to live in Atlanta as well.
Oh.
So his wife is like, okay, I have family here. Can we just move there?
His wife already had family in Boston.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
And as an immigrant, and especially in Somalis, we just do word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody says, hey, this is great place, come down. So that's what happened. Large influx of Somalis came to Lewiston in 2000. That's why the mayor wrote that letter saying, you know, tell your people not to come here.
Right.
But look at where Lewiston is now because of these immigrant people, especially Somalis, moving into Lewiston. That changed, really. The economy and also the character, if you will, of the city.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that some more, about seeing those changes that you saw over time. So we're going to come back to that. So for now, I want you to tell me a little bit. So one of the things that you said you left is like the commuting. You got a job in Portland at the time. Commuting back and forth was kind of not fun. Were there other reasons that you were like, Lewiston is nice, but I'm ready to leave? Like, what were sort of like the ups and downs of
No, it was really good. I loved Lewiston. It was low-key. It was nice. It was a lot of people that I know live there.
Mm-hmm.
I can walk to the halal store, literally walk to it. My doctor was downstairs from my building. So I just don't even have to drive or do anything. I can walk to different places. And I even can walk to my kids' school. So it was really very convenient. Very convenient. Mm-hmm. But the only thing was, you know, getting that job, which was full-time job for the city of Portland, which really provided a good income for me and my family.
Right.
And the going back and forth on the snow. So that's the only reason, other than that, I would not move out of Lewiston, to be honest.
Right. And so tell me about the work that you've done. You had a job, like, initially working for the city of, you said Catholic
Portland.
Charities and the city of Portland.
Yeah.
So just tell me a little bit about, like, you know, the work that you do. You do so much.
Yeah. So I started working for the city of Portland as a case manager for refugee and immigrant services that the city had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically teaching communities, immigrant communities coming to the state, how to be safe when they are in their apartments.
Oh.
So my job was like life skills aid kind of person.
Okay.
Because you have all of these immigrants, refugees rather, coming from refugee camps that did not have apartments like we have here in the United States.
Right.
So these are people who are coming from the camps.
Yeah.
So when they come here, they have to learn how to turn on the stove. They have to learn how to be safe in the kitchen for cleaning things that you clean in the house, making sure they know how to lock so that the children cannot have access to that, making sure to cover the stove and don't leave the stove, you know, on because there are small children. As you know, refugees, we had like tons of kids, so we just wanted to make sure they're safe. Helping them that life skills to have that and making sure they get to their doctor's appointments and things in that sort. So it was really a rewarding thing because you literally have grown people coming here and becoming like a child. Somebody have to hold their arm just to show them around.
Mm-hmm.
And although they were have access to benefits such as WIC, the WIC program, but they don't know what to buy for the WIC because there are certain items in the grocery store that you can buy from your WIC vouchers, but they don't know. So it's always have been, you know, teaching them how to do this. And this is the kind of items that you can buy with these certain vouchers. And that's how to do things. So it's really, really rewarding job that I did for that. And after that job, then I get really again, another job within the city doing public health.
Okay.
So working for the public health division, minority health program, mm-hmm. which was totally different from the life skills side of the job, but now it's like prevention when it comes to health. Okay. You know, teaching people about, let's say, STDs, you know, mm-hmm. things in that sort, you know, breast cancer and how to check, do your checkups, mm-hmm. how to make sure your children are really not doing drugs or not smoking and that, and how to navigate that system yeah. of healthcare, which is really hard for anybody to navigate it, and yeah. let alone someone who does not speak the language.
Yeah.
So I have been doing all of that for a big chunk of my time when right. I came to. But also I was doing something on the side as well, okay. making sure people are registered to vote once they become a U.S. citizens. Okay. So that's another thing that I really, really was doing on my spare time, making sure, because folks do not necessarily register to vote when they become a U.S. citizen. They just get their passport or their citizenship and just leave it there.
But that comes as part of their packet, right? A voter registration?
Well, not before. Oh. Not before. There was a lot of, you know, initiatives that happened,
okay.
I think, the past 10 years.
Okay.
That people, those folks who want to register people to vote, will go to those ceremonies and say, hey, you become a U.S. citizen now. Mm-hmm. Here, I've been through that, and I became a U.S. citizen back in, was it 1998?
Okay.
And there was nobody there. I went and with people
mm-hmm.
who become a U.S. citizen, but there was no tables that saying, hey, you can register, none of that.
Wow.
Yeah, but this initiative started not long ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is interesting. Yeah, and we're going to come back to this yeah. sort of discussion about about politics and the role it plays in you. your life, because you've been doing it. You did your yeah. you know, work, but then also like on the side, like a yeah. type of political
yeah.
Engagement as well. And so you talked about with your work, you know, working with refugees who were coming into Portland and needed to learn sort of, right, how to adjust in these new spaces. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And helping them with those skills. So living in Lewiston, being in Portland, mm-hmm. you know, how do you or how have you sort of defined a community?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Community is everything to me. Mm-hmm. And I always have that African proverb, Ubuntu, mm-hmm. in my head all the time. I am because we all are.
Mm.
And coming from Somalia, if something happens to you, it is happening to me as well. It's affecting me as well. Mm-hmm. So that is what community is all about. Yeah. And I really built a great community relationship in the Lewiston urban area folks, mm-hmm. as well as Portland, because I was working in Portland. So wherever I go, I do know people. Mm-hmm. And with that, it allowed me also to become a member of the Somali Community Center of Maine.
Oh, okay.
So that also is all the Somalis in the state of Maine come in one place, and we always have that one voice. So community has been that big to me always, but I spread it out a little bit because I work with all immigrants mm-hmm. and all refugees and all asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. And that was part of my job. So once you do something for one person, mm-hmm. I can forget that because I can think, that's my job. I did that. But that person that I did that, whatever that was, that I did it for them, mm-hmm. never forgets it. And always right. when they see me, they're like, thank you. Thank mm-hmm. you. I sometimes forget, what did I do? I don't even remember.
Right.
So that is what community means, because you have to do what you can while you are living in the world. That's right. another proverb that Somalis have. Mm-hmm. So that means that's what community is. So community is just life. Community yeah. is humanity. Community is love, yeah. if you ask me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I just, oh my God. Yeah, I breathe for community. Look at this, how to build a community.
Oh, there we go, it's right here.
You might want to take a picture.
As soon as you walk in. No, I love that. And, you know, thinking back to your time when you, if you remember, you know, first, like, moving to Lewiston, and you're talking about like, everything being walkable, walking to school, walking to the halal market, like walking to the doctors. What was, how, you know, how did you think about your community that when you sort of first moved here and was just learning how to move around Lewiston and move around the state?
Yeah, no, actually, because I lived in Atlanta, so that kind of opened my eyes big. Mm. Because when I first come to Atlanta, again, I spoke English very well. But I don't know if you've been in the South. They speak something different. Totally different. So my husband was my interpreter all the time. I'm like, I do speak English. I don't know what this person is saying, though. So I learn a lot through that. And in the South, it's totally different than the North, if you travel. Mm-hmm. So I had my learnings in the deep South.
Yes, yes, yes.
But when I came in here, it was more like, there was already a community here for me that I'd known already. Okay. So I was not like, not knowing nothing.
Right.
And always the language helps. When you speak the language, it helps. It's hard when you do not speak the language. And I really kind of put that in my forefront to help people when it comes to language barriers and make it easy for them. And if somebody wants to go for an immigration interview, I will volunteer my time. Interpreting, I'll do that. I don't remember charging people at all doing that. Right. So, but I took a training to become an ethical interpreter and for 6 months. So after that, I was still, you know, interpreting for people for free, but I stopped working for the city. I think it was 2010. That's when I started my own business doing interpreting in Portland. So it was really good. It was really good, and I was busy doing all of this. But the city called me in again and said that, hey, we have a big position opening. Can you please apply? We want a Somali speaker. So I went there, and again, I love serving people. So I just stopped my business and said, okay, you can wait, and then get on board for the city of Portland again to work with communities of everywhere.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so this is actually a question that's there about the, you know, that we have the role of language in your life. So what languages do you speak and who do you interpret for?
So I'm fluent in Somali. Okay. So that's and at the time, the large community that was in Maine was the Somali community. Mm-hmm. Next to Somali were Southern Sudanese community, but they do speak different languages. They, you know, Acholi, Arabic Juba, they speak, you know, Dinkas, different languages. But the Somali, we speak that one language, although we have, you know, Maimai and, you know, other sub-languages, but the big language that all Somalis can understand is the Somali language. So I do speak Somali, so that was the language that I was interpreting. But I do speak little languages here and there. You know, I can understand, I don't know, maybe 30% of Italian, Arabic, some Hindi that I learned watching Hindi movies. Oh, my God. Got some stories about that.
Oh, I mean, yeah, those movies are 12 hours long. My mom grew up watching those also.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. But the my fluency is Somali language.
Okay. And so you were doing work translating in Somali and English?
Yes. Translation, writing, and interpreting by mouth, too, especially for medical interpreting, which is really very unique. But I'm also a certified cultural broker as well. Okay. So cultural broker, usually our healthcare language or does not have any of those cultural. For example, autism. We don't have that in the Somali language. Right. And there is no way to translate that unless you just say, okay, let me put on my cultural broker hat so that right. I can explain what this means.
Right.
Yeah, so I do have that as well, which is really, really cool thing.
Yeah. So how would you sort of translate something like that kind of culturally?
So you just tell them people that, the service provider, let me just explain this to the client. Mm-hmm. And we just explain to the client that this is something that a child goes through, mm-hmm. and they may not be able to speak mm-hmm. in a certain ages. They might have irritations. They might have get loud music or loud things might bother them. Mm-hmm. They might look different than your own other children. Mm-hmm. So those are what it means when we are talking about autism. But I can tell you a story that happened to me at MainMed. Mm-hmm. I was interpreting for a woman who was, the big up. You see the burqa?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is nothing what I'm wearing.
Right.
She was like, everything was completely, covered.
Right.
So I'm interpreting for her. She had her OBGYN doctor. And the doctor was just focusing on her computer, writing things and asking the questions to the patient. And the question the doctor asked was, do you have sex with multiple partners, men, women? And I hesitated. I didn't say nothing. I'm like, and the doctor felt the buzz.
Right.
And she looked at me like, what are you doing, lady? Translate what I just said. And in her face, she was just like bothered, like, I'm doing something, why this was? I'm like, okay, Decker, you just do it. I tell that to the girl, just like it was. And she just get angry. And she dropped the F word, boom, to the doctor. And the doctor was like, what the heck just happened? I'm like, okay, doctor, I'm going to put my cultural broker hat for you right now. You could have started by saying, I ask this question all my patients, whether they are religious, Christian, Buddhist, mm-hmm. Muslim, whatever they are, it's in my system, and I have to ask everybody with respect.
Yeah.
If you would have started that way, we wouldn't have this response mm-hmm. that we had. And she learned that day.
Yeah.
The doctor learned that day. The woman was furious, and I told her, you know what? The doctor is just following her questions that are in her system. And she didn't mean to ask you this question just because of you. She asks this question everybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So those are the good things about cultural broker hats that you can take off that ethical interpreting hat, which is you have to say exactly what comes out of the service provider's mouth to the client.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that that's interesting because, sometimes when we ask this question about the role of language or interpreting, we assume that it's one way.
Yeah.
And not that also, right, that doctors also have to,
learn
interpreting for them.
Yes.
Here is sort of, culturally appropriate ways to.
Yes, and they come a long way. They come a long way to change those practices and had a lot of workshops with community leaders and say, what's the best way, best practices that we can reach out to communities and ask questions. And so that was good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of questions that are nightmare-y.
Yeah, I can't even, imagine, right, sort of doing doing that work.
Yeah.
You spoke a little bit about your family, right? Your uncle and his wife being up here, you coming up here, son being, where are all the black people?
Yeah.
Up here? Yeah. Your father being very educated and wanting you to also sort of pursue your education.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about your family. Whatever you want.
Yeah. So I married. What was it? 1991. God, it's been so long. I forgot. And I was in Canada at the time, so I came to United States right after that, maybe 1992, because of the process of the green card and all of that, and moved to Atlanta, where my husband was, since 1992.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest son was born in 1993 in Atlanta. So the funny thing is that he was born in January 1st.
he's a New Year's baby.
But all the refugees that you see in Lewiston and Portland and all over the country, they were given January 1st date of birth from the refugee camps. So any given person that you know that is here was born in January 1st. And when we moved here in Maine, you know, after the holidays,
right.
The teacher will say, well, who was born in, you know, January 1st? And he's like, Mom, you cannot believe what I saw. Dad, you cannot believe. They're like, what happened? He's like, everybody in my class with the Somali people was born in January 1st. I just crack up. And he was the only person who was born in January in his classrooms in Atlanta.
Wow.
And so he was always the January 1st baby. And I had to explain to him, I said, all of these people, they did not have, you know, actual date of births. So the United Nations High Commission of Refugees had to make up a date of birth for them. And they would put up, whether you are 70 or whether you are 2 years old, you were born in January 1st. Crazy. Crazy. Just the years are different. Yeah. So now there is a cousin of mine puts every year in January 1st in Facebook, all my Somali people have been happy birthday, happy January 1st birthday.
Wow.
So he was born January 1st, 93, and my second son was born 99. Mm. He is, what is he now, 23, I think. And then my daughter was born in December 2000, actually.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, you are like the child that we were thinking everything is going to shut down.
Oh,
millennials. Like, she's like, oops. And yeah, so they are here with me, and my husband is still in Atlanta. He's just worried about the snow, which I do not understand. We love it here. We're
right.
not going nowhere.
Right.
And I did have a chance to go back to school for that. That was my focus, what I wanted to do. So in 2013, I went to, I did my master's in development policy and practice at the University of New Hampshire.
Okay.
And at that time, I was thinking about, you know, creating a nonprofit.
Mm.
So the only that you can do that in either NGO back home or here is to get to know, you know, to have more development practice and all of those things. But at the same time, I was working as a, you know, social work
okay.
at the City of Portland Refugee Services. So I see all of these people that I am really good at. So one of the interns that we had was like, Deca, you're just so natural when it comes to social services and social work. You've been doing this for a while. Have you ever thought about, you know, doing your master's in social work? I'm like, no, but I just did my master's in them. But yeah, but this is really awesome. So it made me think. So UNE was having they did not have a lot of people of color in their programs in social work. And they were saying that we want to give you half off if you want to come to our schools. I'm like, But me and Regina was like, oh, that's a great idea. So we signed up, both of us, and we did our master's of social work at UNE here in Portland. So.
You all went through that together?
Yes, yes.
Oh.
She maybe graduated like... We did go together, yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I don't even know when we graduated. But we did. 2017 and 2018, I think.
Nice.
Yes. Yes.
So
I had that chance to go back to school, and now Regina she did her doctorate at Tulane, and she's like, you need to do it too. I'm like, leave me alone. I'm not doing it. She's like, you have to have that. I'm like, nope. Not anytime soon. I got too much on my plate right now.
Anyway, yeah. And the kids are all still here.
Yes.
And they went to school.
They went to school, finished their schools. Yeah, my daughter is a senior at Emmanuel College in Boston, but she is home. She's doing her remote because of it's more expensive going there. So that's what she's trying to do, just to save some money.
Yeah.
And my second son, actually, my oldest graduated, but my 23-year-old stopped going to school in the pandemic. He's like, I don't want to do it. Because they were paying kids like $25 an hour for making the kits to check. And he got greedy and he wants to work and have money and pay for his car and all of that good stuff.
Right.
We were just talking this morning. I said, last night, sorry. I'm like, you need to start going back to school, dude.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully. Now he works for Boys and Girls Club.
Okay.
Which he's enjoying.
Yeah.
Enjoying amazingly because there are so many kids that look like him. They've never seen anybody like them, like him or like them working with them. He said, they're all over me, Mom, every single day. I said, because they never seen anybody work with them who look like you. They don't have that in the school. They don't have that after school. So you have to think that you have a very, very important job right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And he's here. So you have your kids are here.
Yeah.
Do you have other family? I mean, you said friends up from Atlanta? Any other family up here?
No, for my uncle, I mean, he moved to Seattle, Washington. Another thing is that Somalis, we are nomads. So we just keep on moving. I said, I can't do it. I said, from Maine to Seattle, what are you doing?
Wow.
So he has two children and they're now in, but I have the bigger community, you know, the community that I built with relationships over the years. And it's just amazing. You know, those people are like family. Yeah.
And so can you tell me about, you know, sort of any sort of traditions and customs that you practice and, you know, things like religion play a role in your life?
Yeah, so we have Ramadan that comes every year and we fast. We all fast together and we eat from different families and friends' houses. We even do iftar here in Gateway, which I am trying to bring it back next year.
Okay.
And we have, you know, the Eid celebration after that where we go to the mosque and pray. And not the mosque, but this bigger.
Right.
This year we prayed at the Fitzgerald Stadium.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, sometimes we pray at the expo.
Okay.
So, because the masjid is not going to hold all of that people. So, it's big. I don't know if you ever seen people prayer, going to that prayer and crossing that streets and all of that. So it was beautiful. This year we went to Fitzgerald Stadium and after that you just go and hang out with families and friends and do all kind of cooking. And if you want to, you can have friends going to Fort Williams, which we do a lot, to do barbecue. And yeah, it's tradition. And I love the fact that it didn't stop. It keep on going. And especially telling that traditions and cultures to the younger generation.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful to see. Yeah.
And so for things like Eid that are larger celebrations, they're sort of big events that sort of statewide, everyone kind of comes to one place.
Yeah.
But then for other sort of, you know, prayers, events, like, are those sort of more local? Do you do those things?
Yeah, so usually men go to the mosque every Friday because Friday is a holy day for Muslims to go all and pray in the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
So usually women don't do that a lot, but men usually do that a lot.
Okay.
And basically people come home and have sweets and eat together and things of that sort. Right. But that's like every Friday. Yeah. For me, I'm too busy for that. I don't do it.
Right.
But if I get invited somewhere, I make sure I go because, you know, I don't want to be missing out because my schedule is really hectic. So but I try to show up for places like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned being very busy. And before we sort of started talking about politics in your life. So tell us, I mean, including the obvious, right? But tell us, right, how do you participate in politics and how does politics play a role in your life?
So politics have been playing a role in my life since I was like a kid. Because I grew up in a household that my father was always against the government that we had in Somalia at the time. My father was a part of a coup that happened in 1960.
Okay.
And he has been in the radar or the, how do you say, the microscope on the Somali government ever since that. and he will go to jail in and out because he will say something. Mm-hmm. And in Somalia, you're not supposed to say anything against the government because you're going to go to jail. Mm-hmm. And that was always something that discussed in my household, and not only for what's happening in Somalia, but also what's happening around the world. Mm-hmm. So coming to this country, I really listen more about what's going on when it comes to politics, mm-hmm. not only in the United States, but again, all over the world. And really, in Atlanta, it's busy town again, and you don't have the opportunity to meet your city councilors or school board members or your governor. You don't have that opportunity because it's a big city mm-hmm. and huge state. So when I came to Maine, although we are a big state, but we are really very small when it comes to the humans that live in this state. It's like, mm-hmm. what, 1.3 million, something like that, mm-hmm. in such a big state. So you get to know who your city councilors are. You get to know who mm-hmm. your school boards are. You get yeah. to know who your governor is. So I had that opportunity to build relationship with different people, state representatives, senators, school board members, just to figure out and navigate around the kind of things that they're doing with the policies that they're making, and also at the same time trying to educate our community because they have a stake in this, because their children are going to this school, so therefore they need to know what's happening because right. they're the taxpayers and all of that good stuff. And really doing that education, and people were like, oh wow, it took us very long time for people to understand the politics in this country. Folks in the immigrant community only used to vote for presidential. That's it.
Okay.
Never local. So it took us a long time to teach them how local is really where it's at, that their vote can count.
Okay.
Because they have that stake. So I have been always involved in it, and people were asking me, you need to run for office, mm-hmm. you are really ready, and you know all of those things. But as women, whether we are black, white, we don't usually step up mm-hmm. fast. And especially when you have this color, mm-hmm. that is even more like no. And especially when you are Muslim, and especially when you have an accent, it's even mm-hmm. bigger. So too many layers. So I always have been mindful of that. And I'm like, no, I'm not really, this is not me. I can't do this. This was not built for me to run for office. The system is not for me. And then I said, a lot of people, good people that I know, was like, no, the system is for everybody. And if we do not really challenge it, then other people will think the same thing that you're thinking of.
Right.
I said, okay, what should I do so that I can feel comfortable that I can run? So a good friend of mine told me about Emerge Maine.
Okay.
It's an organization that trains Democratic women to run for office. I said, okay, that's good. So I took that course. And I really, it opened a lot of things. I mean, opened my eyes, you know, how easy it is to run for office. People who are really making policies for us may not even have any education whatsoever. You know, they're just sitting there and just making policies for us because they can run and win races. And I'm like, wow. And I am doubting myself, you know, knowing all of these things. So I said, okay, cool. But at the time, there was no space for me to run office because my city council was already there, state rep was there, senate was there. So I was like, okay, the only thing that I can do is just support those who have the same values like myself. So that's what I've been doing, you know, helping those people behind the scenes. But in 2018, my city councilor in my district stepped down from his post. He was elected for 3 years, but he only served one. And then he said, nope, that's it. I'm done with you people. He resigned. So the city put out a special election. So I had an opponent, an older person who had, I think, 5th generation South Portlander, business owner, Trump supporter, all kind of things. And what really happened for me was all those relationships that I have been building throughout the years came for me in a big way. And they were like, we will do your website. We will take care of your Facebook. We will take care of your social media. We will take care of the fundraising. All we want you to do is we just want you to knock doors and talk to people. That's it. I didn't have any other job to do but to talk to constituents.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just amazing. People were doing videos for me. People were doing taking pictures, all pro bono.
Wow.
All people that I get to know throughout the year. So it's I always talk about how important community is, mm-hmm. how important relationship building is, and how to really not to stay in just little bubbles that we're in, but to burst that and just really welcome everybody else and make that bigger community. And I am testament of that. It came out, and we won double the number for that election. And that kind of made me think, like, okay, this is really... this can be done.
Mm-hmm,
this
mm-hmm.
can be done. And at the time, it was only Pius Ali, who was the city council,
okay.
an immigrant person in the city, I believe, or the greater Poland area, I believe,
okay.
Who looked like us.
Mm.
And then we had Mickey Bondo, who ran for a school board.
Okay.
Then we had Claude Reguanje, who ran for city council.
Okay.
Yusuf Yusuf, Marwa Ikhlani in Bangor, who mm-hmm. is Egyptian-American. Dina Yaqubi, who is a Syrian-American in Bangor. And Tanya, who is from Cape Verde,
mm-hmm.
no, Haiti.
Okay.
And then we have Falafia, who is from Cape Verde.
Wow.
It just blew up. It just wow. blew up after that. And then we went to this new American, it's called New American Leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So Pius used to go there by himself. Then Sophia, you know, Sophia mm-hmm. Khalid. And he used to go there by himself all the time from Maine.
Huh.
And one time we went there for, I don't know, 6 or 7. The people were like, what happened? He's like, yeah, are you all from Maine? Yes, we are all elected officials from Maine. They were just blown away to
wow.
see that, yeah. So yeah, well, we can change the narrative.
Right.
And it's really, really, but it's not easy for us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking about, I don't know if you were there on Monday when I talked about this young senator in Minnesota, Minneapolis,
mm-hmm.
was saying, you know, we hear this notion of breaking the glass ceiling.
Yeah.
But he said for us it's breaking the cement wall.
Yeah.
Because this system was not built for us. And I love how he said that. He's only like 30 years old, born in Virginia, Somali American, and he's just amazing. So
right.
I'm like, I want to be like you when I grow up. He's like, oh my God, I want to be like you when I grow up. So it's so important for us to really do this so that the next generation can say, if they do it, I can do it as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. And I think it sort of leads into sort of this next question pretty, you know, perfectly of, you know, you move from Lewiston, but you still have a relationship to
yes.
the city. How have you seen it change over time from when you got there to sort
yeah.
of when you maybe perhaps you sort of go back now to visit or the
yeah.
last time you were there?
Oh, the last time I was there was like last month.
Okay.
I'm there. I was supposed to be there last week.
Right.
But I didn't. Something came up. Oh my God, the change. I remember people talking about it. I was not there when that mayor wrote that letter.
Mm-hmm.
But people were talking about it. And yeah. the change that happened ever since that, you know, all those stores that are in Lisbon Street,
mm-hmm.
you know, all those buildings that was empty that now occupied
right.
by people, and you know, the soccer team
mm-hmm.
that is making a difference and put us in us meaning Maine
mm-hmm.
in the national how do you say it?
Like spotlight.
Spotlight.
Yeah.
And the businesses, the people, and all of those things. It's just, and also bringing young people.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are aging state. And especially Lewiston was that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But bringing all of these young people coming in, opening businesses, you know, going to schools. It changed. It changed
mm-hmm.
a lot. It changed
right.
the perspective of Lewiston.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, artists and oh wow! I mean, the mayor, Mayor Carl Schilling, invited me last month. And we were walking all over the place, and it was just amazing. And I had a chance to go to the museum of LA, and that's how I met with the director.
Yeah,
it was really nice, and all of those colorful shoes and
Okay. This is so. This also, you know, I always end every interview by asking people, you know, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think it's, you know, important to share, that you want to share?
I mean, highlighting, you know, the diversity that we have in Maine. You know, we always talk about Maine is the whitest state in the country, but people do not know that we have such a big diversity. We have so much, so many cultures that are representing in Maine. So. It's good always to highlight that who is here. I mean, you know. And hopefully we can do that. Maybe that's a new thing that we should do it in Gateway. To highlight all the Marcells.
Oh, boy. Behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes.
I wouldn't do the interviews.
No. No, but we really have such a talented brown and black women who are doing amazing work behind the scenes. And nobody see them. I want people to see them.
Right.
Yeah. Sublime.
All right.
I'm on it.
I like it.